From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be. Across the nation, around the world, I'm George Norrie, and welcome to the world's most listened to late night talk show, Coast to Coast AM. Your next hour, Noah's Ark and the Great Flood with Dr. PhD type Walt Brown. Did it all really happen? I'm looking forward to this on Coast to Coast. Well, now get ready for this. Despite a congressional mandate banning the sale of common incandescent light bulbs by 2012, the Environmental Protection Agency is warning that their compact fluorescent replacements are not safe to use everywhere. The EPA says breakage of the energy-saving, mercury-containing CFLs can cause hazards, health hazards, especially for children and pregnant women, suggesting use of the bulbs over carpeted areas should be avoided. They say if the bulbs break over carpeted areas, the cleanup may require cutting out pieces of the carpet to avoid toxic exposure. Time for you to all go LED. Mercury is a naturally occurring metal that accumulates in the body and can harm the nervous system of a fetus or young child if ingested in insufficient quantity. You know, for some time now on this program, we've been telling you that an ingredient in the curry spice turmeric may help prevent heart failure. That's according now to two new studies done on rats. In both studies, researchers gave curcumin to rats. The rats then got surgery or drugs designed to put them at the risk of heart failure. The rats that got this showed more resistance to heart failure and inflammation than comparison groups of rats that did not get it. Christian Wild on the line with us now, author of Miracle Stem Cell Heart Repair and Hidden Causes of Heart Attack and Stroke, has been saying for well over a year on Coast to Coast that this reduces inflammation. Christian, there you go. Another study backs up what you've been saying.
Boy, isn't that something? Turmeric, something that you has been around for tens of thousands of years that a pharmaceutical company can't make a buck on. If they could, they'd be selling it and promoting it for a couple $100 a month for a prescription. And now, of course, they're finding it more and more that inflammation is the major killer. And it's a measurement of heat. It's actually the heat that destroys the transmission in your car or the engine or the friction on the tires of the car. And in the human body, inflammation causes heart disease. It causes plaques to disrupt. In Alzheimer's disease and dementia, we've talked about that. It is inflammation. And they know, of course, in areas of India, we've also mentioned that before, that they have the lowest incidence of dementia and Alzheimer's.
Because they use a lot of curry powder.
They use it in their dishes. And when you and I order curry chicken at a Chinese restaurant, that's the same curcumin that that it comes from.
Christian, the spice itself, the curry, in a powdered form or in a fresh form, let's say, does it matter? Still helps you out.
Still helps you out, and it's they did a study recently at the Anderson Clinic in Texas, using Taxol for breast cancer treatment, and using that in combination with turmeric. And they're finding great results. But the study that preceded that one, using turmeric for breast cancer, was done at UCLA several years ago. They took one group of women and put them on tamoxifen, took another group and put the same number on turmeric for 3 months. And at the end of that period, the group that had the turmeric had exactly the same results of the women who had gone through that painful experience of taking tamoxifen.
Well, I've got to tell you, ever since you've been on the program and you told me about taking turmeric, I have every day. And every time I go get a checkup, the good old doc says, "My gosh, how old are you anyway?"
And isn't that good to hear?
It is working.
Yeah, it lowers inflammation throughout the body. It keeps plaques, as I said, from bursting open, what we call vulnerable plaques, the most dangerous of all. Many times when you hear of somebody having a massive heart attack and dying of sudden death who had no other symptoms or no other reasons for it, they can oftentimes find that the C-reactive protein marker was elevated, and that's from inflammation.
There you have it. Christian Wild's website, myheartbook.com, and I really, really want all of you to go to that and just look at the information that he's been providing for some time now. It's incredible work. He was just on the program during Heart Month in the early part of this month, and he'll be back again. Christian, thanks again for this update on this incredible two research projects. The Los Angeles mayor has signed one of the toughest laws on pet sterilization, requiring most dogs and cats to be spayed or neutered by the time they are 4 months old. They want to avoid and reduce the thousands and thousands of deaths that are conducted in Los Angeles's animal shelters every year. In Australia, a horrible scene, a 16-foot python stalked a family dog for days before swallowing the pet whole in front of horrified children in the Australian tropics. The boy and girl, aged 5 and 7, watched as the python devoured their little chihuahua, and apparently this python had been just waiting in the lurches for this little chihuahua. Scientists fear that the Burmese pythons, already known to be breeding in South Florida, could spread through much of the southern United States. Climate maps produced by the U.S. Geological Survey show that the giant constrictors, native to the tropical forests of Southeast Asia, could find suitable temperatures in an area that includes the Southeast as far north as Virginia, most of Texas, southwest part of California. In a moment, biologist Robert Reed joins us with this incredible story. Scientists, by the way, are priming two spacecraft to slam into the moon's south pole to see if the lunar double whammy reveals hidden water ice. The Earth on Moon crash may raise some eyebrows, but NASA believes that such missions can yield extremely useful scientific observations. On the line with us now, Richard C. Hoagland at enterprisemission.com, darkmission.com. You've got too many titles, Richard. Way too many titles.
Way too many.
How are you?
I'm pretty good. And you?
Good, good. Now, NASA taking aim at the moon, what's really the purpose here?
Well, it's to find out if we can live on the moon. You know, the main problem of living on the moon is there seems to be nothing there to live on. If you have to carry oxygen, you know, water, hydrogen, hydrocarbons, metals, tools, food, everything to breathe, it's absolutely a fortune. You know, every pound is thousands upon thousands upon thousands of dollars, like $100,000. So if you can find stuff on the moon to live on, to live off the land, you can reduce the cost of NASA's plan, the Vision for Space Exploration, enunciated by the president back in 2004, to go back to the moon and basically live there. So what they're going to do almost exactly a year from tonight, George, they're going to send a spacecraft, a large upper stage called a Centaur, to basically crash into the moon. The launch takes place in October of this year, but 86 days later, with the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter in orbit around the moon, there will be this second stage that launched it coming along behind in a very long orbit that loops around the Earth a couple, three times and comes back and hits the moon 86 days after launch. In February of 2009, it will be 4,000 pounds dead weight crashing to the moon at several miles per second. And the explosion, which will be equivalent to thousands of tons of TNT, will kick up something like 1,000, you know, tons of lunar material. They will then fly the second spacecraft through the plume and measure in situ with little sniffers and gas chromatographers and whatever, the actual composition. And what they're hoping they're going to find when they kick this thing into the southern unlighted regions of the south pole of the moon is that there is water down there in the form of ice, which we could put a moon base down there. And since water can be used as rocket fuel, it can be used to breathe oxygen, you can use the hydrogen and hydrocarbons. If they found a source of water, a stable source of frozen ice, in some of those craters, it would make a permanent moon base for the whole world incredibly more practical than it is tonight.
That's incredible. And you support this mission?
Totally. Now, I got a surprise for you, George.
What's my surprise?
How would you like to have your own private mission, you and this audience, the Coast audience, to the moon?
I'm going. Let's do it.
This is unmanned now. This is a robotic mission.
How do we do this?
This is a precursor. To be revealed in weeks to come, I'm working on something that is so amazing, and this audience has been involved all the way in our investigations of what's on the moon and the publication of Dark Mission and all the revelations there. I thought it would be appropriate to announce the actual plan on your show when we're ready. We're not quite there yet, but I just wanted to give you a heads up that if you're interested, and, you know, guys out there, email George and let him know if you're interested. We have a way to have a coast-to-coast mission to the moon to confirm what I've been saying is there for the last decade or more.
All right, I'm looking forward to this. You know, I've got a vision of you on a rocket ship with bicycle pedals, but I'm not sure that's what it is. Richard, thanks a lot.
You too, George.
Richard Hoagland, EnterpriseMission.com and DarkMission.net. In a moment, Robert Reed, biologist, joins us. We talk about this really serious story of Burmese pythons breeding all over the United States. Back in a moment. Let me bring in our guest now for the hour. Bob Reed is a research wildlife biologist with the U.S. Geological Survey in Fort Collins, Colorado, receiving his undergraduate degree from Berkeley, his master's from Arizona State University, PhD from Auburn University. Been all over the map, focusing his research on snakes, rattlesnakes, boa constrictors, and he's with us now. Hey, Robert, thanks for coming on at this short notice. I appreciate it.
Hey, George, it's nice to talk to you.
First of all, this horrible story out of Australia of this python swallowing this poor little chihuahua. I mean, what's so unusual about this? This thing's getting coverage all over the planet now.
You know, it is funny. You just mentioned how in Southern California alone, we're putting down thousands of dogs a year, and yet we've got this news article that is one dog on the other side of the world, and we're really interested. And I think it has a lot to do with the fact that humans have an inexplicable fascination with snakes. Snakes evoke really strong emotions. Those are usually completely divorced from any facts associated with the case. You also mentioned a couple of the other factors that really make this article interesting to people. First of all, the poor little children standing by while their beloved pet is swallowed.
Yeah, and there's a picture.
And the photo. Yeah. And then I really think that, for me, the most fascinating aspect was that this 16-foot python was seen coiled in the dog's bed a few days previously, and the family apparently did nothing about it. And I think people really enjoy reading an article, and afterwards they can say, you know, I might have had a bad day, but at least I'm smarter than those idiots in Australia.
Yeah, coiled in the dog's bed?
Yeah.
Like, you know, maybe the python got jealous, huh?
Yeah, and I'm thinking, you know, how does a 16-foot python fit in a bed made for a chihuahua anyway?
God, Robert, when I was in St. Louis a couple years ago, we had a story of a couple that had a python, and they let it stay in an aquarium, and they put like a brick on top of some screen top. They let it stay in this thing in the room of their little child. Well, the thing killed the little kid. It broke out and killed the baby.
Yeah, those are really the most tragic kinds of deaths from snakes, because they're entirely preventable. It's usually carelessness on the part of an owner. The majority of deaths by large snakes in the U.S. are the snakes actually killing their owner. And those tend to be young males because, of course, you know, testosterone is a poison and it makes you do dumb things by a giant snake.
And they sleep with these things sometimes too, don't they?
But when you start endangering other people, then you really have to wonder about the wisdom of owning these animals.
I got to tell you, you know, I love dogs. I love cats. I even like a blowfish floating around in a saltwater tank. But these aren't pets, are they?
Well, you know, a lot of people really are fascinated by the snakes, and the reptile trade in the U.S. is now worth somewhere on the order of $2 billion a year. That includes animals, cages, food, et cetera.
And iguanas, everything.
And my personal feeling is that the snake may not recognize you as an individual. They certainly can be beautiful animals. They can be fascinating to watch. They have got a lot of really neat behaviors. But the really large animals are definitely potentially dangerous. And if you're someone who's had it since it was 18 inches long, you might tend to overlook the fact that, yeah, this thing now weighs 90 pounds, and it is capable of smushing the life out of you.
I saw a picture on the internet, I don't know if it's real, of people somewhere catching a huge python or an anaconda or something, and they cut it open, and inside was a human body. Is that real?
Well, it has to be real. It was on the internet.
Yeah.
You know, there are a whole bunch of pictures that are circulating on the web. Some of them are almost certainly faked. Some of them, it's harder to tell. A couple of them have been tracked down and are believed to have some level of reliability. But, you know, a lot of these are from someone's camera phone in Indonesia, and it was passed along through 50 different channels before it got to us. So a lot of them, it's really hard to tell.
Well, let's get into the story at hand this hour now with you, Robert, which truly is kind of scary, to tell you the truth, because, you know, when you think of these huge Burmese pythons breeding in South Florida and now making their way north, making their way west, making their way east, and I understand the female can lay, what, up to 100-plus eggs?
Yeah, right about 106 is the maximum.
Now, how widespread is this, and how did this problem start?
The problem started with pythons that were imported for the pet trade, and there are a couple different arguments as to how they got established in extreme South Florida and the Everglades. One is that they were released by pet owners when they became too big to handle, and the other is that large numbers of them were released when pet stores were smashed by Hurricane Andrew in 92. I think that the geographic evidence of where the pythons sprang up supports the released pets idea better. Thus far, they're still confined to South Florida. They are spreading northward. They've now left the confines of Everglades National Park, heading north and northwest. But, you know, this climate matching map that we produced that shows that they've got the potential to spread to a lot of the U.S. Doesn't mean that they will spread to those areas necessarily. We're saying that the climate from the native range, we collected a whole bunch of sites where pythons are present in their native range in Asia, and then used that those climatic data to project a similar climate in the U.S. And so that means that based on climate alone, the snakes might not necessarily be limited to spreading well out of Florida and into the southeast, up the eastern seaboard, potentially farther to the west. However, there may be all sorts of other ecological factors that could slow them down or stop them completely, like food availability or the availability of places to hide. So the fact is they are spreading. There's no doubt about that. And individual pythons are capable of moving long distances. Snakes with radio transmitters implanted in them in Florida have moved on the order of 20 miles in a month, which is a really big movement for a snake.
And can they adapt to the climate so maybe they can make this migration?
I think that's the biggest question. So in their native range, they're found in places with wintertime temperatures that dip below freezing every night for a month or two at a time. And the question is whether the snakes in South Florida, which are probably originating in the pet trade, which probably means they're Southeast Asian snakes, do they have the capability to adapt to cold temperatures, or will they adapt as they move northward?
These things attack alligators.
Yeah, yeah. One of the sensational press releases over the last few years was the exploding python found in the Everglades, and it was a python that had eaten a 6-foot gator and had subsequently exploded. The exact circumstances are kind of hard to figure out.
Do they kill the gator first, or do they just swallow him whole? Maybe he tried to bite his way out.
They almost always kill their prey. There were some suppositions that the gator was only stunned or unconscious, and then it managed to claw its way out the side of the body of the python. But if so, it was still dead. So, yeah, the gator and python thing goes both ways. So.
Robert, stay with us. We're going to come right back. I want to take phone calls, questions for you, and perhaps also you might want to share one of your strange animal stories with us this hour. And also, you know, what can we do if someone, for example, is sitting under a tree and one of these pythons grabs them and starts to squeeze them? What can we do to get away? We'll be back with Bob Reed in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, you've got the number. We're going to take your phone calls with our guest, Robert Reed, now. Share your animal stories with us, or if you want to chat with him as we're going to continue about these pythons breeding throughout the southern part of the United States, specifically now in South Florida. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. I'm with biologist Robert Reed. We're going to take your phone calls. Bob, so somebody's sitting under a tree and one of these pythons comes down and starts squeezing him. How do you get away from these things?
Well, I think, first of all, you've got to notice that this is a giant snake that, in its native range, coexists with humans, and the reports of attacks on humans are almost non-existent. So I want to make sure that we don't give the impression that, you know, people should stop enjoying the great outdoors because of the threat of these snakes, because I think it's a vanishingly low-odds proposition. That said...
Except for the one guy who gets it.
Well, yeah, and to be honest, I think that if there are human injuries in the next few years, I'd be surprised if it's something other than someone hitting a giant snake at 75 miles an hour on the road and flipping their car.
You might be right.
But, you know, if someone were to be attacked by a large snake, if there's someone else nearby, it's actually not that hard to unwrap a really big snake if you start at the tail end.
Do they bite you?
Yeah, they do.
They do bite.
They've got a lot of really big teeth that are all facing backwards at an angle.
God. I mean, do they, like, bite your face?
Well, if a python that were to attack a human would probably be a fairly big individual, which means they'd probably be down on the ground. And they're just going for wherever they can get a purchase. And so they'd probably grab it mid-body or below, although it's possible they could go higher, and then try to start wrapping and constricting. If you're by yourself and you've got a really big female python on you, you're going to have a heck of a time getting away. But like I said, if there's anyone close by, it's really not that bad. And but it's important to, like I said, remember that.
Well, how do you unwind the thing, or what do you do?
If you're by yourself?
Yeah.
That's a good question. I don't know.
Ram into a tree and try to, you know, smash it or something.
I think that the odds of injuring it by trying to bash it against something would be really low. They're incredibly tough animals.
Oh, man.
They can really take a beating. If you can, you know, locate the head and the head is not covered by coils and you've got something like a pocket knife, you know, you could do some serious damage to it. But I think the main hope is that someone else is going to be close by and they can help unwrap you.
And that's the name of the game, unwrapping you, right?
Right, right. A lot of people think that these snakes kill by suffocation, and it's actually, death can occur faster than that when they're constricting a prey item. So it seems to be that they squeeze so hard that they raise the blood pressure to the point that the heart can't move blood anymore. And so you're basically you go unconscious because your brain isn't getting any new blood and new oxygen.
Okay, let's go next. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, George. How you doing?
Good.
Hey, buddy. You know, I used to live in I'm calling from Tucson, Arizona tonight, but I used to live down in Daytona Beach.
Yep.
And my roommate had a couple, he had a Burmese python that was probably about 12 feet long. It was called Monty. And he also had a ball python that was about 3 feet long. And one morning we woke up basically and the ball python was gone. We'd left the back door open after a night of drinking a few beers and we never saw the ball python again.
They're incredibly good at getting out of cages. And once they're gone, it's just like they vanish. I've had people who had an 8-foot python that was loose in their house for over a year, and they never knew it was there. It was just laying low, and once these things find a good warm crevice to crawl into, You might never know they're there.
Bob, so, how does the male python find the female python if they were lost separately, you know, miles away, for example?
That's a good question. Snakes have amazing sensory abilities. And so the male python will be cruising through, and he's tongue flicking all the way, and he picks up the smell of that female. The female lays down a scent trail of pheromones as she moves by, and the snake's tongue is sensitive enough that the male can flick at that scent trail and decide which way the female came from and which way she's going.
Incredible.
And then follow her. And then in the Burmese python, you actually have a sort of orgiastic mating where a bunch of males will gather around one female, and the males will all compete for mating.
If we're getting 100-plus eggs per breeding, let's say, how long does it take for them to hatch?
Hatching is 2 to 3 months, depending on the temperature.
What percent of the 100 hatch?
Well, Burmese pythons actually brood their eggs. So they wrap themselves around the eggs. If the temperature goes down, the female starts shivering,
mm-hmm.
and her muscular activity raises the temperature of the eggs up to 12 degrees. And so they've got a pretty high hatch rate. The average clutch size is much lower, probably 35 to 50. I think the biggest clutch that's been found from a female in the Everglades, though, is 85, which is an awful lot of eggs.
It sure is. How big is the little baby when it comes out of the egg?
Not quite 2 feet, anywhere 18 to 24 inches. And they are the fastest growing snake known. They can grow over 4 inches a month in really good conditions.
That's pretty fast.
It's amazingly fast.
Let's go to our East of the Rockies line. Richard, you're on the air with us. Hi there, Richard.
Hi, George.
Yes,
and
sir.
Your guest. Very happy. Love your show.
Thanks, Richard.
I was in Vietnam in the infantry in 68 and 69, and my last month I had this bridge duty about 40 miles out of Saigon, and it was surrounded by an Arvin, a South Vietnamese soldier camp. And one of the soldiers, he was friendly with me. I'd give him sea rations. He'd give me some soup. He had a pet python about 8 feet. So he had it around him one day, and I says, wow. You know, and he says, yeah. And he put it on top of my shoulders. And it was pretty friendly. And his son came over. His son was about 5 years old, and he started slapping it in the head. And I'm going, don't do that. But he doesn't understand me. Anyway, it curled around my left bicep. I'll never forget this. And when the kid hit him like the third time, it flexed. Like if you shook hands with somebody, but your hand was like 100 times larger.
Yeah.
And it started crushing my arm immediately. And he was right around my neck, too. So I pulled him off my head, and the guy wrestled it off my arm. But I would say this, if it was around my chest, and I'm a big guy, I'm like 220 pounds. If it was around my chest, I would have been dead, I think, within seconds.
They're incredibly strong. Basically one tube of muscle on each side of their spine. And once they start squeezing, once they have an animal by the chest, every time that animal breathes out, the snake takes up a little slack. And so they're constantly reducing the ability of the animal to breathe down to the point where there's no way to get air into the lungs.
Well, that's what I could say. When he squeezed my arm, it was like when you get a blood pressure test.
Yep.
When you feel like it's
going to
burst.
Feel that pressure.
Even,
sure.
Even worse than that.
Okay. Hey, thanks. Robert, are you concerned about this breeding situation of these snakes?
Oh, very much so. Invasive species in general are bad news, and this is a top predator that we've introduced to U.S. ecosystems. We really have no idea what they're going to do. I mean, they're already eating everything from wrens to white-tailed deer in South Florida, and that includes some federally endangered species already. In their native range, they've eaten things like leopards. It's an animal that is supremely adapted to eating large amounts of food, growing fast, and getting to the point where it specializes on mammals. And they're the kind of mammals that people really care about. Things like, you know, Florida panthers and bobcats and white-tailed deer and all these other guys. And those animals will disappear down python gullets. And I think some sort of control activities need to start being initiated. There are a lot of movements towards that direction, and we're doing a lot of work, but thus far, it's still pretty limited.
Are you starting to get some exposure about this problem, or is it just well-known down in Florida?
You know, in Florida, it's really well-known. When we put these maps out that show the potential climate range of the snakes in the U.S. based on the native range climate.
You're getting close to St. Louis, by the way.
Yep, and that really unleashed a lot of attention. I was out sick one day last week, and I was pretty glad I was because I got back and there were, I think, 15 media inquiries on my phone.
Well, at least we're going the right way.
Yep.
Let's go next to our first-time caller line. Hi, Jake. You're on the air, and you're down where, Jake, in Florida?
Yes, sir. Miami, Florida. I'm a shooter, independent video down in Miami. I do a lot of stuff in Everglades. I can definitely attest to the fact there's pythons down there, and I've seen them. I got buddies that go out there and catch them and stuff like that. It's my first time calling. I want to give a shout-out to my friend Crazy Lee in Tucson, Arizona.
Hey, Crazy Lee.
Got me into this show.
All right, my
That's
man. Go
Crazy
ahead.
Lee. But definitely the pythons are out here. I'm getting them on video. It's true. I know that just in Australia a couple of days ago, they have stuff on the internet about one eating a dog.
Yeah, we hear that
It took about
story.
6 hours. I'm sure that you already talked about it and stuff like that. I just tuned in right now. But they're out here. They're in the Everglades. I'm getting them on video.
How easy is it for you to find them, Jake?
You take the Tamiami Trail, which is 8th Street. You go past the Miccosukee Indian Gaming out into the reservation, out in Big Cypress National Park. You head out there, and you'll see them. You'll see them next to the gators. There's owls hooting. Every natural damn occurrence that you could think of is going on out there. The crickets are screaming. The snakes are biting.
Jeez.
The sawgrass is swinging in the wind. It's midnight. The moon is out. And I've seen them out there.
Have you ever been attacked?
Nah, I've never been attacked.
Well, that's one good thing. So it sounds like they're all over the place, Bob.
You know, they've reached pretty high densities. It's pretty hard to come up with any sort of reliable population estimate. It's certainly in the thousands. I suspect we're in the tens of thousands. But other than that, we don't know how many there are. And they're so hard to detect that even if you find one crossing the road, you don't know if that means that there's 10 more in the swamp next to you or if there's 200 in the swamp next to you. You just have no idea of the fraction that you're actually seeing compared to what's actually out there.
Can you outrun one?
Oh, definitely. Pythons are ambush predators, so they don't rely on speed to catch their prey at all. They're fairly slow movers. I mean, if you're capable of a decent walk, you can get away from a python that's moving.
Does a snake make any vocal sounds at all or anything like that?
Not really. These snakes can hiss, but that's mostly a defensive reaction.
Uh-huh.
So if you walk up on one, they'll hiss at you. And it does sound like a hell of a tea kettle.
Oh, sure. So other than coming through the brush, you're not going to hear this thing.
Yeah. You're probably not even going to hear it coming through the brush. The way that they move, they're just moving the little tiny scales in their belly to move forward so they can move in a perfectly straight line. And they are nearly silent. We released a 13-foot female that weighed about 100 pounds who had a radio transmitter implanted in her, and we were doing that so we can understand their movements. And that snake disappeared within 10 seconds into some marshy grasses.
Yeah.
And I was absolutely blown away by the fact that within seconds, this massive animal had completely vanished, and we had no idea where it had gone.
And I'm sure they camouflage themselves well.
They're very well camouflaged. They've got a mottled pattern like a lot of snakes do.
Do they swim?
They swim very well. The one that I mentioned that had moved long distances, it seems that most of the long-distance movements, at least in South Florida, occur after the Everglades have flooded, and they're very efficient in the water, so they can move a mile a day pretty easily.
Let's go west to the Rockies. You're on the air with us. Hello there.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. My name's Erin. I'm in Colorado Springs.
Okay, go ahead.
I have a question for your guest. It's not actually snake related at all. It's actually about the Southern Rockies Wolf Restoration Project. And I was wondering if you knew if that was actually going to be happening, since you're in the Fort Collins area. I was wondering if you knew anything about
it. Are you up on that?
You know, basically, I don't know much more than what's in the papers around here, to be honest.
Okay.
All right, there you go. What is the project, Erin? I'm curious now.
It was something, actually, I did a research paper for my wildlife management class on the wolves of Yellowstone and ran across it. And they're trying to reintroduce the wolves up into, I believe it was Rocky Mountain National Park.
Yeah, Rocky Mountain National Park.
But they were trying, they were, I guess, in the stages of talking about doing it, and I was wondering if that was actually something that was going to happen, or...
I think it's one of the options that people want to see happen to help control the elk numbers, because the elk are really grazing parts of the park down to nothing. But... I think the political opposition right now is still pretty strong to bringing wolves back to Colorado.
What were you doing in Guam, working on brown tree snakes?
Well, that's the other part of my job. Brown tree snakes are a snake that's native to Australia and New Guinea, and they made it to Guam apparently with war surplus material after World War II. And Guam before that time had no native snakes, and indeed not much in the way of any kind of predators. And the snakes basically just found a smorgasbord. And within 40 years, they completely wiped out 11 of the 13 native land birds on Guam and drove the other two almost down to extinction. So it's one of the sort of poster children for why we shouldn't be moving animals around the planet willy-nilly. This is a snake that caused huge ecological devastation. The big fear now is that it'll sneak onto a cargo container or onto an airplane and make it to Hawaii.
Jeez.
In which case, Hawaii also has no native snakes and a whole lot of naive animals. So a lot of our work is focused on coming up with control tools to knock down the snake populations, ways of detecting them if they do get to a new place, and similar research efforts.
I feel sorry for that little chihuahua in Australia.
Yep.
Wrong place, wrong time.
Yeah,
And he probably,
really don't know.
You know, he probably was playing with the snake, didn't realize what he was doing.
You really got to wonder about someone who saw that snake in the dog's bed and didn't do anything about it, and then was surprised when it ate their dog.
Was this a pet snake?
Oh no, this is a scrub python. It's the largest snake in Australia. 16 feet is actually pretty close to the maximum size for that snake. So something like a chihuahua would have been like eating a jujube to a snake that big.
Oh, amazing. Okay, so what do you do next, Robert? What's next on your plate?
We've got, let's see, we're still dealing with some of the backlash from the Python Climate Match maps with some of the pet industry folks who think that means we're saying that the pythons will spread out and that means the trade should be shut down. That's really not our goal at all. We're just trying to show that... this snake might not be limited by climate to the extent that people think, and that pythons are not necessarily like, you know, Ka the python in the Jungle Book. They don't all live in the jungle. So we've got some field trips planned to the Mariana Islands to work on brown tree snakes, and an awful lot more work in Florida to do yet.
Okay, Robert, thanks so much for coming on the program. Very educational, my friend.
I had a good time. Thank you, George.
Thank you. Robert Reed, biologist. Man. Learn more about pythons than you want sometimes, huh? Well, I'm not into snakes. I'm just not into snakes. But I'll tell you what I am into, the search for Noah's Ark. Dr. Walt Brown, he's up next on Coast to Coast AM.